Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Genesis chapter 32. I'm going to cover the first 21 verses, and I'm going to call this audio Jacob Prepares to Meet Esau. Our context is this. In the last part of Genesis 31, last chapter, Laban has come after Jacob, and he's about to do Jacob in, really, and he has a dream. God says, leave him alone. Well, so Jacob, that was at Mizpah, which is right south of the Jabbok River, and that's where Jacob is right now. But he's escaped Laban, and the next thing he finds out is that his brother Esau is coming towards him, and Jacob thinks that perhaps Esau has murderous intentions, and so he has jumped from the frying pan into the fire. So here we start now at Genesis 32, verses 1 and 2. Now, as Jacob went on his way, having left Mizpah, he's going north a little bit now to cross the Jabbok River. I don't know why he's going north since Bathsheba's to the south, but he did. The angels of God met him. Jacob said when he saw them, this is God's camp. So he named that place Mahanaim. Mahanaim. Now, why did angels show up with Jacob? Well, we're going to look at some options as to who these angels were, but assuming they're regular angels, this was to show that Jacob, that God was with him still. Jacob had just left the hostility of Laban, and now he was headed towards the hostility of Esau, and he needed some encouragement. Remember, he does not have an armed camp. He does not have a military option. Now, God had promised to be with Jacob. We see in Genesis 28:15, God told him, behold, I'm with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. That was at Bethel, where the vision of Jacob's ladder occurred, the dream occurred. Genesis 31:3, our last chapter, we have the Lord saying to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you. So that with you twice. Genesis 28, Genesis 31, it is an awesome thing to have the God who created the universe on one side. Jacob needed that because he was in a bad way. He was in a tight spot, and God's still encouraging him. He's going to keep the seed alive, the promise alive, without violating anybody's free will. And so angels were sent to encourage Jacob. Now, who were some of these angels? Or what are some options as to who the angels were? The NIV Study Bible speculates that these were the same angels that Jacob had seen in his Jacob's ladder dream at Bethel. Ellicott has a variation of that. He says maybe Jacob didn't see the angels physically at Mahanaim. Maybe he saw them in a dream. Another option as to who these angels were, they could have been prophets. Remember, the word angel in the Greek is angelos, plural is angeloi, and that can be translated as messengers as well as angels. And the Septuagint has angeloi here, which is angels. That could be messengers. So it could be some prophets who are giving messages to Jacob to encourage him. That's what prophets do. They encourage people. A third option is from Ellicott, is that these angels were a caravan that gave Jacob timely information about Esau's presence in Seir. In other words, they're just messengers that said, hey, we just got some news about Esau down there south of the Dead Sea in Seir. He's coming at you. Fourth option is these angels were a body of men sent by Rebekah from Beersheba to aid Jacob in repelling Esau. Well, I think all those are reasonable, and I really don't know what the answer is, so I'll report. You decide. Now, this place is called Mahanaim. Mahanaim, if you look at the map, BibleAtlas.org, you go up from Mizpah about, 5 miles, go northwest of Mizpah and cross the Jabbok River. The Jabbok River runs into the Arab Valley between the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea, about two-thirds south, down from Galilee, about one-third up from the Dead Sea. The River Jabbok, well-known river, and Mahanaim is right there on the border. I think it's on the northern border. I'm pretty sure it's on the northern border. There is a question mark, however, by the name, so they're not exactly sure of where the camp is. Now, what does the camp mean, the name? It means two camps, as the NIV note says. Now, why is it named two camps? Well, I got five options as to why it was named two camps. First option, he could refer to Jacob's camp and Laban's camp. After all, Jacob had just left Laban's camp. Maybe. Option number two, he could refer to Jacob's camp at Esau's camp, because Jacob is anticipating meeting Esau, and he's going to put Esau in one camp, and he's going to stay in another camp. That would be two camps. Option number three, the angels' camp that Jacob had just seen, these angels, the angels' camp and Jacob's camp. Now, this seems to me a little bit more likely because of the phrase here in Genesis 31 verse 2, Jacob said when he saw them, when he saw the angels, this is God's camp. So, therefore, he named that place Mahanaim because he saw it was God's camp. He saw the angels, therefore, he's going to name it two camps because we got the angels on one side representing God and we got Jacob on the other side. Fourth option, these are two camps because of Jacob's divided his own people into two camps. If we drop down to verses 7 and 8, we read this. Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. He divided the people with him into two camps, along with the flocks, herds, and camels. He thought, if Esau comes to one camp and attacks it, the remaining one can escape. All right, a fifth option is that Mahanaim, two camps, could refer to two camps of angels, two companies of angels, one camp on one side of Jacob and one on the other side of Jacob. That's John Gill's suggestion. In my opinion, the best way to look at this is that Jacob divided his people into two camps so that if Esau attacked one, the other one could escape. I think that's the most simple, the simplest, straightforward way to interpret that name. Now, Mahanaim is an interesting place. It shows up in biblical history a lot. Let me give you a run through of Easton's Illustrated Dictionary. Mahanaim, two camps, a place near the Jabbok beyond Jordan where Jacob was met by the angels of God, where he divided his retinue into two hosts. It seems to me that Easton is taking the two camps of Jacob as the origin of the name Mahanaim, two camps, and I think he's right. The name was afterwards given to the town which was built at that place. It was the southern boundary of Bashan, became a city of the Levites. Saul's son Ish-bosheth reigned here while David reigned at Hebron. After a troubled reign, Ish-bosheth was murdered by his own bodyguard there, who brought his head to David at Hebron. Many years after this, when David fled from Jerusalem on the rebellion of his son Absalom, David made Mahanaim his headquarters. He mustered his forces from there to fight against Absalom. It was at the gate of Mahanaim that the news of Absalom's death reached David, and he started crying hysterically. So, this place will show up again as we go through the Old Testament. We go down to Genesis chapter 32, verses 3 through 5. Then Jacob sent messengers before him to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. He also commanded them, saying, thus you shall say to my lord Esau, thus says your servant Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed until now. I have oxen and donkeys and flocks and male and female servants. I have sent them to tell my lord that I may find favor in your sight. Now Esau's living in the land of Seir. If you look at a map, that's at the southeastern corner of the Dead Sea. Moab runs right down on the eastern side of the Dead Sea, right down to the southern tip, and then Edom starts. And it runs down for a ways in the Araba Valley down there south toward the Gulf of Aqaba. So Easton says that Seir is the name of a mountainous region occupied by the Edomites, and I've been there. It is extremely mountainous, all right. It's nasty. Extending along the eastern side of the Araba from the southeastern extremity of the Dead Sea to near the Aqaba, the eastern branch of the Red Sea. Aqaba is now a vacation spot in Israel. I spent the night there once and had to drive down south from the Dead Sea down to Aqaba, so I got to see all this. I was basically in Seir. I didn't realize it at the time because I didn't know geography very well then, but that's what it was. And it's really rough. It was originally occupied by the Horites, who were afterwards driven out by the Edomites. It was allotted to the descendants of Esau. So it would make sense that Esau was in the land of Seir since it was his land. He basically ended up conquering it. The Edomites were the descendants of Esau. Again, I'm reading from Easton's. And of course, later, it was called Edomia in the New Testament. It was mountainous. Mount Seir referred to the rough hills on the east side of the Araba. The Araba is the valley between the Dead Sea. Well, it's the Jordan River's in the Araba Valley, and when it gets to the Dead Sea, it goes from the Dead Sea to the Gulf of Aqaba, and that valley there is called Araba all the way down. Mount Seir, or the Edomites, extended from the head of the Gulf of Aqaba, the Elinitic Gulf, to the foot of the Dead Sea, as I've just said, and contained, among other cities, the rock-hewn Selah, generally known by the Greek name Petroid. I've been there, too. That's a place that everybody, if you get a chance, you ought to go see that place. The Nabataeans, the people who lived in that area, built that city in about 600 or so A.D., I think. But those mountains there on the east side of the Gulf of Araba is where the Edomites live. Petra's a little bit to the north. You go up to get to the southern tip of the Dead Sea and go up a little ways before you get to Petra. But all the way from Petra down to the Gulf of Aqaba, that's Seir. That's where the Edomites were. It is a wild and rugged region traversed by fruitful valleys. Its old capital was Bozrah. I think that was in Moab, which was what was later called Moab. The early inhabitants of the land were Horites. They were destroyed by the Edomites. I've already mentioned that. We can read about this in Deuteronomy 2:12. The Horites formerly lived in Seir, but the sons of Esau dispossessed them and destroyed them from before them and settled in their place, just as Israel did to the land of their possession which the Lord gave to them. Israel got the land flowing with milk and honey, and Esau got a bunch of rocks and sand. Well, there was a few fruitful valleys in there. I mean, not saying it's all bad, but it's a really rough place. Now, Seir is far to the south of where Jacob intended to go, as the NIV Study Bible says. Jacob wants to go to Beersheba, and Seir is to the south of Beersheba. Beersheba is about a third of the way north from the southern tip of the Dead Sea, and then you go west about halfway to the Mediterranean Sea, and that's where Beersheba is, and that's to the north of Seir. But why did Jacob send messengers down to Seir, even though that's not where he was going? Because Jacob assumed that Esau, upon hearing of Jacob's arrival, would come north to meet Jacob, which is what happened. How did Esau get the land, since Seir, the land of Seir, was the land of the Horites? Well, he perhaps married into the family, or maybe militarily drove them out. We don't know. Now, Esau's living to the south of the Dead Sea down there. The question is how did he get there? Because the last time we saw him, he was with his mother and father, Isaac and Rebekah, in Beersheba. Well, Jameson Fawcett Brown speculate that Esau's two Hittite wives, Basemath and Judith, they were Hittite women, and they drove Rebekah so crazy she said, "I'd rather die than live with these women." They must have been real works of art, and so it could be that Isaac got fed up with them and says, "Get out of here, Esau." It could be that Esau just liked that wild country down there of Seir. Esau liked adventure. He liked the chase. He liked to hunt, as we have read in earlier chapters. And maybe this was to his liking that he voluntarily went down there. But for whatever reason, he was down there and living in a state of power and influence. And Jacob is afraid. Jacob tells the servant to call Esau my lord in verse 4. Now, Jacob here acknowledges the superiority of his brother. He wants his servant to acknowledge the same. Adam Clark points out that the time had not yet come when the elder would serve the younger. Remember, God had told Rebekah this, the elder would serve the younger, and Jacob's the younger, and Esau's the elder. But at this point of the stage, Jacob is thinking about, I'm serving the elder because he's got all the wealth and the power, and I've just got a couple of manservants here to protect me, not much, a bunch of shepherds. And also we need to remember that Isaac was not dead yet, and Isaac had always favored Esau, so Jacob's weak from that aspect. Also, since Isaac was not dead yet, Jacob had not come into his inheritance yet, the same inheritance he cheated Esau out of yet, so he didn't have money from that end. He didn't have any family influence, and he didn't have any of his inherited wealth. He's got to be humble before Esau, and he was. He says, he gets his servant to call Esau my lord, and then he says, refers to himself through the words of his servant, your servant. So Jacob is your servant, Esau. This suggests both courtesy and humility. Now in verse 4, Jacob tells the servant, tell Esau I have sojourned with Laban. Well, why bring that up? Why would Esau care? Well, this was probably a way to arouse some sympathy from Esau, because sojourning meant that Jacob was in exile from his home. So he's trying to play Esau a little bit. And then in verse 5, Jacob tells the servant to tell Esau, I, Jacob, have oxen and donkeys and flocks and males and female servants, and I am sent to tell my Lord that I may find favor in your sight. Well, why is he bragging about his wealth? Why do that? Well, here's some options from John Gill. Option number one, well, from Gill, Clark, and me. Option number one, so Esau wouldn't think Jacob was coming to ask him for material assistance. Adam Clark says this. In other words, Esau, don't worry about me mooching off of you because I'm your brother. I got plenty of money. Don't worry about it. Option number two. This is from Gill. Jacob tells Esau about all of his wealth, so Esau wouldn't be ashamed of Jacob. Esau wouldn't think of Jacob as someone who ran away from home and had nothing to show after 20 years. I don't believe that. I don't think he's worried about Esau being ashamed of him. This is my opinion, option three. Jacob wanted to show Esau all that wealth, so Esau would be less tempted to kill him, because Esau might think there's a material advantage in keeping Jacob alive. Jacob might give me some gifts. Of course, if he killed Jacob, then Esau might then be the one to inherit Isaac's wealth, perhaps. I don't know if Jacob's thinking that far ahead. I think he's thinking maybe I'll show Esau all this wealth, so Esau might think, oh, maybe Jacob will bribe me, get rid of me that way. We go now to Genesis 32, verses 6, 7, and 8. The messengers returned to Jacob, that's Jacob's servants who went down to see Esau. They returned, saying, we came to your brother Esau, and furthermore, he is coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him. Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people who were with him and the flocks and the herds and the camels into two companies. For he said, if Esau comes to the one company and attacks it, then the company which is left will escape. 400 men, that's a round number probably, and it stands for a sizable unit of fighting men, as the NIV Study Bible says, and which is a lot more than Jacob had, and it scared him. Now, we see what Jacob's reaction was. What did Esau mean for these 400 people to mean? These 400 armed servants. Well, it doesn't say armed servants. It says 400 men. We assume they're armed. John Gill says one option is he did it to show Esau's grandeur. Esau sent him down there to show what a big shot he was. Second option, he sent him down there to honor Jacob. Adam Clark believes that to be the real motive. Esau wasn't trying to intimidate Jacob. He was trying to give him honor. Oh, look at here. My brother's come back. 400 people are going to escort him further along his way. The third option is that Esau wanted to harm Jacob, which is, of course, how Jacob perceived it, and that's no surprise, given how Jacob had cheated Esau. Adam Clark says one's guilty conscience naturally leaves one defenseless and afraid, like Jacob was. Well, I don't know what Esau's motive was, but my guess is he was still a little bit upset, and he was going up there going to take care of Jacob. In verse 7, our text says that Jacob was very afraid, and that shows that, as Adam Clark says, that Jacob had forgotten God's promise of protection. This promise was in the previous chapter, verse 3, Genesis 31:3, then the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you. This is when Jacob and Laban were having their, when Laban's attitude started souring, and Jacob was thinking it's time to get out of Dodge here, leave Padam Aram, leave Syria, and go back to the promised land. Now, when Adam Clark says that Jacob had forgotten God's promise of protection, I really think he's being a little bit hard on the man. I mean, I'd be scared too. It's real easy to, in the press of current circumstances, to forget a promise that God's given to you. I believe that's why there were certain visitations to Abraham when the seed had not shown up, when his wife was barren for so many years, and you tend to forget these promises, even if you had them in a vision. How many times have we done that? Fear is a natural emotion, but faith is not an emotion. You can believe something while fearing. So you can believe the promises of God, but you can still have natural emotions of being scared to death when somebody's coming at you with 400 armed men and you are defenseless. So he divided his camp, Jacob did, so that if Esau attacked one, the other perhaps could get away. Now Adam Clark says this is clever, but Jacob had always been a clever, cunning man, has he not? Now, how could one camp have escaped if one camp of Jacob was attacked? Well, here's some options as to that. First option is, while one company was being attacked, the other could flee. But as John Gill points out, well, where are they going to flee to? Ah, but here's probably the answer. The first camp would be attacked, and the 400 men who attacked it would satiate themselves with revenge and plunder, raping the women, or enslaving them, maybe both, enslaving the children, capturing all the booty, all the sheep, and all the flocks, and all the camels, and all the herds, and all the donkeys. And they would be so busy doing that, they would have no desire to capture the other half. And if you read enough ancient history, this happened all the time. Ancient armies did this. And a lot of times while they were busy plundering the camp, the defeated army would turn around and wipe them out. It just happened constantly. And so this is probably a reasonable, probably what Jacob was thinking. It's better to lose half my goods and family than to lose them all. It's a terrible choice to make, but it's better than losing everybody. We go now to Genesis chapter 32, verses 9 through 12. Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac. Now the NIV has prayed. Jacob prayed this. God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, Jacob prays. O Lord, who said to me, return to your country and to your relatives, and I will prosper you. I am unworthy of all the loving kindness and of all the faithfulness which you have shown to your servant. For with my staff only I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two companies. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, that he will come and attack me and the mothers with the children. For you said, this is Jacob still praying to God, you, God, said, I will surely prosper you and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which is too great to be numbered. Now, the NIV Study Bible says that this is the first recorded prayer of Jacob since he left Bethel, and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown go even further and say this is the first recorded example of prayer in the Bible. 32 chapters before we see the first prayer, I think that's kind of interesting. Now, this, of course, doesn't mean that Jacob didn't pray on a regular basis. It's the only big ones at strategic points that the Scripture is going to record such prayers. Now, Adam Clark points out that this was a model prayer. Let me quote from him, quote, "This prayer is remarkable for its simplicity and energy, and it is a model, too, for prayer, of which it contains the essential constituents. 1, deep self-abasement. 2, magnification of God's mercy. 3, deprecation of the evil to which he was exposed. 4, pleading the promises that God had made to him. And 5, taking encouragement for what God had already wrought." It's not a bad way to pray. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says about this prayer of Jacob, quote, "It was the prayer of a kind husband, an affectionate father, a firm believer in the promises." Now notice who Jacob is praying to in verse 9. He says, "O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac." Jacob turns to God as his first source of help. He didn't turn to Rachel's teraphim, the household gods that Rachel has stolen from her father Laban. I wonder if Jacob even knew that Rachel had stole the teraphim. Given all the deceit that was going on in his family, as we pointed out as we've gone through this story, I doubt it. I doubt Rachel bothered to tell him, "Hey, I almost got you executed by Laban because I stole, without telling you, I stole Laban's household idols." Notice also that Jacob didn't pray to the angels, assuming these were divine angels that had just appeared to him. Unlike certain New Age people would say today that all they can think about is angels to whom they pray. Now, Jacob in this prayer is quoting something God had said earlier. God had said earlier to Jacob, "Return to your country and to your relatives, and I will promise you." That was happened in the previous chapter when Jacob realized that Laban's attitude was souring, Genesis 31:3. "Then the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you." So God had just told Jacob that, and he repeated that back to God. Remember, God, you told me you're going to be with me. Well, I need you now because I'm in a world of trouble. Jacob refers to this Jordan in verse 10. He says, "For with my staff only I crossed this Jordan." Mahanaim, if you look at the map, is right on the banks of the Jordan River. So this Jordan means it was close enough to point to and see, maybe. Probably close enough to see. And when he says, "With my staff only I crossed this Jordan," that's talking about when he left Bethel. Then crossed the Jordan to go to Syria, to Padam Aram. That's all he had was a staff. He was dirt poor. He was skint, as the British like to say. But now he's come back. He's got two companies, the two companies that he had divided into two camps. He had enough sheep and goats and ewes and lambs and camels and donkeys and male servants. He was rich. And he gave God the credit for making him wealthy. And once again, God is not a socialist. God prospered him. Nothing wrong with being productive, using the tools of production and using your skills, working hard, making money. Nobody's got any right to take that money away from you. Of course, God expects you to be charitable with that money. And if you aren't, he'll find ways for some socialist to take it away from you, or some catastrophe, or some criminal, or some bad business deal. He'll find ways to take the money out of your pocket if you're not giving with it. But there's nothing wrong with creating wealth, and in this case, creating sheep and flocks. Now in verse 11, Jacob says to the Lord, "Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother." Remember, Esau was trying to kill him when he left 20 years earlier. This is in Genesis 27:41. "So Esau bore a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him." In other words, the blessing that Jacob had hoodooed Esau out of. You know the story. "And Esau said to himself, the days of mourning for my father are near. Then I will kill my brother Jacob." So yeah, this was... Jacob was not just being paranoid here. He had a real fear of what was going to happen to him. "I fear him," he says, "and he will come and attack me and the mothers with the children." So Jacob thought his brothers were going to kill women and children. He must have really had a bad attitude about Esau. Then Jacob in verse 12 quotes God again. He says, "For you, God said, I will surely prosper you and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which is too great to be numbered." Now that would be referring to God's promise to Jacob at Bethel when Jacob had the vision of Jacob's ladder. Genesis 28:14, "Your descendants will also be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east and to the north and the south. And in you and in your descendants shall all the families of the earth be blessed." There's the dust of the earth metaphor. Well, how is Jacob going to have descendants as the dust of the earth if Esau comes and wipes him and his children out? That's why he repeats that to God. You promised me, God. How's that going to come to pass if Esau wipes me out? God, of course, is going to deliver Jacob just like he prayed. Genesis chapter 32, verses 13 through 15. So he, Jacob, spent the night there at Mahanaim. Then he selected from what he had with him a present for his brother Esau, 200 female goats and 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams. 200 females and only 20 males. The females were more valuable because they could produce more goats. 200 ewes and 20 rams. Same thing with the sheep. Ewes the female sheep, 200 females, and 20 rams is the male sheep. 30 milking camels and their colts, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys and 10 male donkeys. Again, more females than males. They're more valuable. This recalls to mind that proverb in Proverbs 18:16, a man's gift makes room for him, and he brings him before great men. Well, Esau was a great man, and Jacob's given him plenty of gifts. This is very typical of Eastern cultures. I lived in China for 23 years, and I'm telling you, that is a gift-giving culture. I could give you a ton of stories about that, which I want. Now, notice that Jacob is not being super spiritual here. He doesn't just say, oh, God, deliver me. He's saying, I'm going to do something to help me get delivered. He used prudence and foresight by giving Esau a huge gift. Now, included in this handsome gift to Esau were milking camels. John Gill says that milking camels were held in great esteem in the East. He quotes, or he refers to Aristotle and Pliny, Aristotle the Greek philosopher and Pliny the Roman writer, who both say that milking camel's milk is the sweetest of all milk. So this was an especially valuable part of the gift. Adam Clark says that modern nomadic Arabs, consider that milking camels a principal part of their riches. So I mean, Jacob is going all out. He finishes with 10 donkeys in verse 15, and you add up all the other heads of livestock, you get 550 head of cattle he's given to Esau. John Gill says this is a very large number. A very good gift for Esau. Adam Clark says, quote, this was, quote, a princely present and such as was sufficient to have compensated Esau for any kind of temporal loss he might have sustained in being deprived of his birthright and blessing. So Jameson, Foss, and Brown say that Jacob is offering to make restitution for the injury he inflicted upon Esau. And, you know, everybody says that Jacob tricked Esau and blah, blah, blah. But we've got to remember, Esau made that bargain deliberately. He sold his birthright for a bowl of lentil stew and some bread. Jacob didn't make him do that. He might have tricked his father when it was time to make the transfer of the blessing, but the blessing was supposed to go to Jacob because Esau had sold it to him. But at any rate, Esau's not going to look at it that way, and Jacob is offering to make it good. Genesis 32, verses 16 through 18. He, Jacob, delivered them, the presents, into the hand of his servants. Every drove, that's the NASB translation for herd, every herd by itself, and said to his servants, pass on before me and put a space between the herds. He commanded the one in front, saying, when my brother Esau meets you and asks you, saying, to whom do you belong and where are you going? And to whom do these animals in front of you belong? Then you shall say, these belong to your servant Jacob. It is a present sent to my lord Esau. And behold, Jacob, is also behind us, behind the servants. Now, when Jacob told his servants to pass on before me, he means cross the river Jabbok and head south, assuming the Mahanaim is on the northern shore of the Jabbok River. Put a space between the herds. There's probably three herds. Of course, you got to have two to have a space, but also there's a third herd in verse 19, which says, then he commanded also the second and the third and all those who followed the droves. So it sounds like it was three separate herds. Now, the question is why did Jacob do this? Here are some options. Option number one, to prolong time. Esau would have to stop and talk with the servant leading each herd. Well, my response to that is, well, isn't that just delaying the inevitable? If Jacob's not going to flee, I guess maybe he could head out of town. He could try to escape somewhere. I don't know how, where he would go to escape, but at least it'd buy him some time. He could maybe perhaps escape. Option number two as to why Jacob did this is so that Esau would be impressed with the size of the gift, as John Gill says. The gift would hit Esau in waves, so to speak. So Esau's mad. He says, oh, here's some nice presents from my brother Jacob. That's nice, but I'm still mad. Then he goes a little bit further. Oh, here's some more presents from my brother Jacob. Well, I'm still mad. And so then you go to the third herd. He says, my gosh, my brother Jacob sent me three herds of all these milking camels and cows and sheep and goats. Me, he's a good guy. That's kind of the idea, and I think that makes sense to me. That's John Gill's idea. Now, Jameson Fawcett Brown, his suggestion as to why Jacob did this was this. If the gift of the first herd was refused by Esau, the following two herds could then retreat back to Jacob. Well, that's fine, but that would take time. Esau could catch up, and that would seem to delay the inevitable, which is those 400 men of Esau were going to wipe Jacob out. So I think the answer is Esau was going to be impressed with the size of the gift. That is the reason why Jacob divided the gifts up into three. Now, verse 18 tells us the formulaic words that Jacob's servants were instructed to say to Esau. These belong to your servant Jacob, and as a present, said to my lord Esau, and behold, he also is behind us. Those words are repeated in verse 20, where the servants are said to say, before the second and third herds show up to Esau, before each herd shows up, the servants are instructed to say the exact same words. Behold, your servant Jacob also was behind us. Now, the three repetitions of exactly the same words would convince Esau that the words were from Jacob, as Jameson Fawcett Brown says. Now, I don't know if they're right about that. That takes a lot of speculation and deduction, but maybe so. Why would Esau think the words weren't from Jacob? I don't know why repeating the words exactly would help Esau believed that it was from Jacob. I don't know if that's necessary. So maybe that's a speculation that goes a bridge too far, maybe. But at any rate, verse 18, the words that the servants are supposed to say include the words, your servant Jacob. That shows humility. And then they're supposed to say, Jacob is behind us. In other words, he's on his way. This is to keep Esau from thinking that Jacob was using the presence as a smokescreen so that Jacob could flee. That's John Gill's idea, and I think he's right about that. We go to Genesis 32, verses 19 through 21, and we'll finish up this section. Then he, that's Jacob, commanded also the second and the third and all those who followed the herds, saying, after this manner you shall speak to Esau when you find him. All those who followed, that would be the servants, the shepherds that were following the herds. After this manner, in other words, in the same way, I think the NIV says, say the same thing. When you speak to Esau, when you find him, say the same thing. This emphasizes Jacob's desire to have a uniformity in wording to impress Esau. Assuming that Jameson Fawcett Brown are right about that, this would impress Esau that this really is Jacob. And it's repetition, 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 accompanied with a huge gift each time. This is very clever. Jacob's a clever guy. So the servant passed on before Jacob. The gift of all the flocks and herds, passed on across the Jabbok River on before Jacob, while he himself spent that night in the camp. Now, what camp is that? Well, that's probably Mahanaim, the same camp he just named. It could be the camp of the servants as opposed to Jacob's tent to avoid Esau coming into his tent and killing him. Well, that would be smart. But at any rate, in our last verse here, verse 21, Jacob himself spent that night in the camp. Actually, it was only part of the night because, as we'll see in our next audio in verse 22, now he, Jacob, arose that same night, and then they crossed the ford of the Jabbok. So we'll stop it here. We'll take that up in our next audio as we see Jacob crossing the Jabbok River in that nighttime so he can wrestle with the angel of the Lord. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.